Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Joanne Koenig lived a quiet, private life as an elementary school teacher. Then she got sick. But as her autoimmune disease progressed, Joanne never complained or even brought attention to her ailment.
Writer Alyssa Eli tells her story as part of the Remembrance Project, the stories of ordinary men and women who lived quiet, extraordinary lives.
Joanne Koenig died October 22, 2014, on Martha's Vineyard. She was 75 years old and would have wanted no fuss over remembering her. Most of her life, Joanne was a teacher. To her three daughters, her 10 grandchildren, and the hundreds of elementary school students who rotated through her classroom with its hand-culled collections of shells, bird nests, sand dollars, and its bulletin boards under perpetual reconstruction. During summer vacations, Joanne's family used to search for monarch caterpillars and carry them back to the class so her students could follow their life cycle. She taught that way for 28 years. Joanne was one of six, and while her other siblings moved south, west, and even north to Alaska, she stayed in Massachusetts. She met her husband on a ski trip, married young, and worried devotedly about his health to the end, even though the largest medical problems were hers. Around the time she began teaching, Joanne noticed the first symptoms: thickening joints, disfigured hands, fragile and breaking bones. It was scleroderma, a rare autoimmune disease. She rejected her handicap parking placard, asked her daughters to help thumbtack the classroom bulletin boards, and never mentioned how hard it must have been to spend all day keeping pace with energetic youngsters. The closest she came to disclosure was when she told a daughter that the children didn't want to hold her hand anymore. An intensely private person, she was forced to live with an increasingly visual secret. It didn't stop her determined life, though. When friends and family called, she changed the conversation immediately from her to them. She read prolifically and found her way back to an early love of painting watercolors. With an educational focus, of course, she and her husband traveled from a Frank Lloyd Wright house to the Forbidden City. Crossing the Somalian Sea, their cruise ship was attacked by pirates. That drama was widely covered by media, but Joanne took a more characteristic view. "The press made such a big deal of it," she said. There was no photograph on the mass card at her service. Instead, there was a picture of a hydrangea she had grown. Gardening was a passion until the weeks before her death, even when she could only reach her perennial beds in a golf cart. Joanne would have disapproved of her own picture, too attention-seeking. But the hydrangea, unbowed, was an accurate portrait, too.
Alyssa Eli, remembering Joanne Koenig, who died last fall on Martha's Vineyard. The Remembrance Project airs every week on Radio Boston. If you'd like to nominate someone for the series, you can email remember@wbur.org or go to radioboston.org for more information.
Being a referee is a thankless job. Do it well, and nobody notices, but make a mistake and absolutely no one forgets.
With the NCAA basketball tournament underway, March Madness, we thought we'd spend a few minutes considering the high-pressure work of the officials. And this year, there's been no shortage of controversial calls, including a technical foul last Friday against Providence coach Ed Cooley. With his team down 8 points and just a few minutes left to play, Cooley huddled up his team and tried to fire them up by knocking over a chair.
And for this, veteran referee Terry Oglesby gave Cooley a technical foul, to the amazement of commentators.
As Ed Cooley was huddling up with his team, Cooley took the chair, threw it down. The officials teed him up.
That's wrong. That's bad. I mean, you got to talk things through here when you're an official. You got to be a reasonable person.
A reasonable person whose job it is to keep the games from descending too far into madness.
As our next guest says, refs stands stand dead center in that snarled intersection between the pursuit of victory and the principle of fairness. Bob Katz is the author of The Whistleblower, Rooting for the Ref in the High-Stakes World of College Basketball. He'll be at the Brookline Booksmith tonight, and he's with us now. And Bob Katz, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you.
So you write that most people overlook the officials in sports, that they are only noticed when something goes wrong. And I'm curious, what got you interested in writing about basketball referees?
It struck me, and I would hope it would strike many listeners if they thought about it two or three times, as I've come to do, that there is a game within a game that goes on from the referee's perspective, which is they're in the middle of the action, they're moving around, they're constantly scurrying for the most optimal perspective on the action that's taking place. They're constantly trying to manage the temperament and the manipulations of the coaches and the players, and that it was that through the eyes of the referee, I and readers of my book hopefully would come to be able to see basketball sort of from the inside out, all the action that we know from watching a telecast, but simply from a different and, I believe, fascinating perspective.
Now, you write about one referee in particular. So tell us about Ed Hightower, because he's a pretty fascinating guy off the court. He grew up in poverty in the rural segregated South. And when he's not officiating basketball, he's the superintendent of a school system near St. Louis. And that interests me because I would have assumed these guys are full-time refs, but they're not. And Hightower is an example of that.
So the focal point of my book is, as you say, Ed Hightower. He's what you would call an elite, certainly an elite referee. He's refereed the national championship game four times, the Final Four 12 times. Upon learning that college basketball referees, unlike their brethren in the NBA, have day jobs, it is not their full-time profession, I thought it would be interesting to try to write about a college basketball referee who had a day job that would somehow parallel or illuminate some of their responsibilities on the court. I learned about Ed Hightower, as you say, he's a man who was raised by sharecroppers in very, you would say, underprivileged circumstances, earned a PhD in education, runs an entire school district right outside of St. Louis in Edwardsville, Illinois. And the kind of back and forth between his job administering a school system and jetting off to high competition basketball games to try to create or establish fairness on the basketball court is a yielded for me as a writer, and I hope for the readers, a set of revelations about what it takes to make it fair, both in schools and, of course, on the basketball court.
Well, speaking of what it takes, I mean, you describe this guy as perhaps the most maligned basketball official ever to have presided over a college game, and that perhaps the phrase he hears most is, "Hightower, you suck."
So the ice is broken. We can say that.
Well, I guess I just said it,
yes.
Maybe controversially. But anyway, how do officials learn to ignore that kind of abuse that comes from the stands?
Well, it for one, it's so prevalent that just by overexposure, I think they learn to ignore it. Beyond that, I don't think any of them consider the hollering that comes out of the stands at them to be an assessment of whether they've done the job well or poorly. With regard to the "Hightower, you suck" phrase, in the book, I show several instances where he's involved in completely uncontroversial plays that would be obvious to anyone, even, as I say, the mother of the accused, and yet the fans start hollering. It seems to me it's almost a component of the spectator sports experience to reserve the right to yell at the official whenever it feels right.
Hmm. But does it get through to them? I mean, did you hear from Hightower or from other folks that you talked to that, at a certain level, we can hear what the fans are yelling, the folks in the stands are yelling?
I really think they're completely inured to it. They hear the coaches a lot more, and they hear the coaches who, when they are being accused of things that maybe the refs themselves have some misgivings about, and that is a different kind of interaction and a different kind of experience for the refs.
Do refs like Hightower care who wins or who loses, or are they just totally focused on the smooth running of the game?
Well, more the latter, and to me that was one of the more fascinating parts of my exploration of the world of college basketball referees, is coming in with a question, do they really not care who wins? Is it possible to be, as I say, immersed in the action with all the tension and emotion going on and have no partisan views whatsoever? And I put this question to Ed Hightower at one point, and he had for me what was rather a surprising answer. And he said, well, in fact, we do care. We care. Our goal as referees is to establish fairness, to establish balance, and we care that the team, if the team who has played best that day wins, it does kind of please us. Now, that is not the same kind of caring that a fan sure. brings to the game, where they want their favorite team to win more than anything.
So the refs sort of take on this charge that if they're doing their job correctly, the team that plays the best should win.
No, not exactly. They if they do their job correctly, it's a little more nuanced than that. They believe they do if they do their job best, they have given the team that plays the best a fair chance
to
win.
I see. Interesting. So after spending time with the refs, how do you describe what their biggest challenge is? Is it being impartial, managing the abuse, staying calm, or managing people?
There's a phrase that one of the referees said to me that I think is almost like a mantra or a mission statement, if you will, for their profession, which is, he says, our job is to absorb the chaos, create calm, and ensure that the outcome is fair. Their greatest challenge, many of them would say, is just managing the game. And that is an increasingly complicated challenge because, for example, they cannot revert to the video monitor to review calls as often as they might like. They're precluded by league rules and by a lot of telecast concerns from doing that. So even though their foremost responsibility is making the calls right, that is by no means the only challenge they face.
Well, Bob Katz is the author of The Whistleblower, Rooting for the Ref in the High-Stakes World of College Basketball. He'll be appearing tonight at the Brookline Booksmith at 7 p.m. There's more information at radioboston.org. And Bob Katz, thanks so much for coming in and talking about this really, really interesting story. We're very grateful.
Great to be with you.
Well, let's stick with the world of sports and say hello to Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. He joins us on Wednesdays to talk sports. Hi there, Bill.
Hello, Magna.
I'm going to guess that you're too much of a gentleman to ever hurl insults at referees.
You're right.
Okay, good. Just double checking, given what we just heard.
Not since I was about 11.
All right. Well, let's start off with the Boston 2024 Olympic bid. There was something of an about-face, I should say, this week from the private groups that wants to bring the Summer Games to Boston. They said now that they back a voter referendum on the game. So, Bill, what do you think?
I think it was more than something of a reversal. I think it was a very obvious reversal, and I think it was an attempt by Boston 2024 to try to get control of the agenda, which is what powerful people try to do under these circumstances. And it'll be very interesting to see whether they succeed.
Bill, it's interesting that it comes just as WBUR released a poll last week that found support for the games had fallen to just 36%. The New York Times calls this an inauspicious development for an already shaky bid. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think when the backers of the bid who had opposed the referendum, and I'm speaking not only of Boston 2024, but also of the mayor, completely reverse their field and claim they want to sponsor a referendum, the smell of desperation is on the breeze.
Well, we know that public opposition can sink Olympic bids. I mean, it's happened in a number of cities across the world, happened in Denver. What's your prognosis for Boston?
San Moritz, Krakow, Munich, Oslo. It's the Winter Olympics in those cases, but it happened in all those cities. Yeah, of course it could happen. And Boston 2024 is on the record now as saying if the people of Boston don't want it, even if Massachusetts votes yay, if the people of Boston vote nay, the bid will be over. Now, again, that's an easy thing to say in March of 2015 when the actual referendum will not be conducted for some time, maybe not until the next presidential election, according to what I read in the paper today. We will all have forgotten that promise is part of the deal. But, a referendum that goes against this thing could derail it. And if the referendum goes against this thing, goes against the Olympics, it should be derailed because it shouldn't happen if the people don't want it here.
Bill, let's move on to the National Football League. The league is in the midst of considering rules changes for next season. One of them concerns the so-called Julian Edelman rule. Mm. Tell us, what that is.
Well, it means that if a player is stumbling around in obvious distress and falling on his face, and the coach does not see fit to take him out of the game...
happened to Julian Edelman.
Yes. A so-called spotter will have the power to stop the game and... cause the player to be examined by a coach and by somebody presumably with some medical background to decide whether that player should remain in the game or not. My only issue with this is that the spotters, as I understand it, will be on the NFL payroll, and I don't think the NFL is going to want to have the game interrupted 12 times for players stumbling around. So I just don't know how effective this is going to be.
Oh, this is interesting. So while on the one hand they could potentially overrule a coach, they still have what you see as inherent conflict of interest.
I think they have a conflict of interest in the sense that everybody on the NFL payroll is concerned with keeping the game moving and keeping the entertainment package intact. And people, fans, are going to complain if the game is stopped as often as it could be for somebody who may have just suffered a concussion.
It might end up being as slow as baseball. Okay. Well, the league is also voting on other potential rule changes, I understand, today?
Yeah, and some of them are completely beyond my understanding, but at least one of them, I think, suggests that Bill Belichick will no longer be able to demonstrate that he knows more plays than anybody else and is smarter than all other coaches.
I'm
not sure.
And you have to explain that.
That's my interpretation of the rule. It's something about whether a guy can come in and say, I'm ineligible, but
oh,
depending
right.
on where he lines up.
Yeah, Belichick made some hay with
yes,
that.
Yes, he made some hay with it in the championship game. And he is already on the record as saying, these people who are proposing rule changes do not understand all the implications of the changes they're proposing, which is another indication that he is, in fact, smarter than anybody else in the room.
Bill, we just have a few seconds left, but it, also in football news, and speaking of Belichick, the Patriots and the Jets are at each other's throats off the field. This involves some tit-for-tat. Last December, the Patriots filed tampering charges against the Jets. This week, the Jets filed their own charges against New England. What's this about?
It's a clear indication of the NFL's attempt to keep football in the news, despite the fact that the NCAA basketball tournaments are in progress, it seems to me.
Okay. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. It airs Saturdays at 7 a.m. and again at 7 p.m. He joins us every Wednesdays right here on Radio Boston. Bill, thank you.
Thank you, Anthony.
And he may be the only person that is smarter than Bill Belichick. Can I say that, Bill?
You can say it. I don't know if anybody believe it.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.